Good evening. My name is Sam, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here tonight. As it was mentioned, I have been here before, and it's a great meeting. I love this meeting very much. I have a lot of good friends here. And, you know, I want to thank Mark for the 10-minute speaker. I think he did a great job. You know, that was a very good job. Before he spoke, we were sitting down there, and I told him I wish I was the 10-minute speaker, and you were the main speaker, you know. And he said he's really nervous, and I said, you're nervous? I mean, guess what happens to me? I mean, at least he could speak English when he gets nervous. I get nervous, I forget everything, even my own language. But you did a great job. Thank you. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an honor for me to be here tonight. I want to thank Tony for asking me to come down here, and it's a privilege. They told me I had forgotten that they're making a CD of the talk, and then they said it's going to be on the internet. And when the guy tried to coach me before the meeting, you know, is it okay? We are going to have it live on the live stream on the internet. And the first thing came to my mind, you know, is God, I have to speak English all the time. You know what I mean? But you might be able to say from my accent that I'm not from San Diego, you know, although they introduced me right. And I was born in Tehran, Iran. And I came here. I landed in Chicago in 1976, and then I came to San Diego in 1987, and I have been in San Diego ever since. I mean, you were talking about your childhood. Mark was talking about his childhood. My childhood was that my father was a high-ranking officer in military, and then He was a general, and then he ran our house like an army base. And he wasn't just general. My mother was second in command. And then I have three sisters. Me and my sisters were E1s. That means we did not count at all. Although later on I found out that who was in the chief in command. My mother was in first in command, not my dad. And, you know, they wanted me. They had a lot of good. I was there. The older son, you know, they had a lot of plans for me. They wanted me to go to good schools. They wanted me to get, become the doctor, engineer. They sent me to really good schools. And from the beginning, I learned how to play my role so they can leave me alone. And I didn't know about a lot of feelings I had, or, you know, that we talk about not being part of, being isolated, you know. All these things I didn't know, none of these things until I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I had all the symptoms, although I did not pick up a drink until I got to college, because there was so much pressure on me to get good grades. They sent me to one of the best high schools back home, and then it was very hard to get into that high school. You had to have really good grades to get there, and then you had their curriculum was like, you know, it was one of the top school that more, you know, 80% of the people graduated from high school from this school, they got to universities. They could pass, you know, the exams to get to college. And the year, it was such a big deal over there to get to universities because we didn't have that many institutions we have here. In the year I graduated from high school, there was a national exam that everybody has to take it. And that year, I think there were about 300,000 students, high school graduates. They took that exam. Only 11,000 got through colleges, you know. So it was such a big deal. When I passed that exam and I went to university, it's like, they thought I was on my way to become the doctor and engineer, everything that they always dreamed of. So I had potentials to become somebody. But a lot of pressure was taken off my shoulder, and this is the time that, you know, I went to college and everybody was drinking, and I started drinking because I wanted to be grown up. I wanted to be like everybody else. And the way I started drinking is there was a liquor store This is before revolution. Back there was a liquor store by university campus, and they, you know, they sold liquor and they served liquor. At 9 o'clock in the morning, I would stop by the liquor store, and the guy would pour me a tall glass of vodka and a couple olives next to it, because I've seen that in the movies. That's how people drank. And I would just pick up that vodka and I would down that with a couple olives as the wash. And the guy, the owner of the liquor store, would look at me and say, "Man, I have never seen a young guy like you coming in drinking like this." And that made me feel really good, that I was somebody, something, you know. And, of course, the first 2 weeks, I remember that as soon as there was an alley right by the liquor store, behind the liquor store, and as soon as I get out of the liquor store, I come in and I throw my guts out. But when it stayed down, it made me feel all right. And I didn't know that that was the beginning of a long journey, that I drank alcohol because it made me feel all right. I hated the taste of vodka at that time. You know, it didn't taste good. But I kept drinking and I enjoyed it. I went out with the boys. And from the beginning, I had these things about that. If you could drink a bottle of vodka, I would outdrink you. I would drink two bottles. And I didn't. I always like extremes. I don't know what is it that with me, that I wanted to be either to far right or far left. I thought the middle line is like mediocre. That's like, you know, I didn't like it. And that's why when I was about 16 years old, I got into religion. I got I became an Orthodox Muslim. I was going to mosque and praying. My parents were not religious at all. And, then I got to college, university, and we started, at that time it was fashionable that you start reading philosophy. I started reading a lot of philosophy books, and I got introduced to materialism philosophy, and then Marxism and socialism, and it becomes so attractive, you know, when I was in college, and I was ready to pick up a machine gun and joined the underground guerrillas fighting against the Shah at that time. Oh, you know, I mean, it's like my dad was working for the government. He's in military. I'm trying to join the guerrillas, you know, and I'm drinking and everything is all right. I was going to classes drunk. Every day, and but somehow I was getting good grades. I was getting passing grades, and I was doing okay. I studied physics, and after a few months drinking, I started smoking pot, at the university, and we have hash over there. They call it hash. They don't, not the same thing we have here. And I know this is an AA meeting, so. I did drugs only once, from 1971 to 1988. You know, all I can say about drugs, I started smoking pot because what it did, it made my eyes red and small. And I thought it made me more romantic, Somehow I managed to get a degree in physics back there. And then my parents were well off financially, and it was fashionable at that time. They sent me over, I came here to the United States for higher education. We didn't have that many graduate schools. We had some, but we didn't have that many. So there was, another exam I passed, and I landed in Chicago in 1976. And I went to University of Illinois at Chicago. And I started studying, for my master's degree. And I got friends, and, alcoholics, we can find our own people. And I found my own people. And we started drinking and partying here, and I enjoyed it very much. And I was getting good grades at the same time. I don't know how, but I was getting good grades. And after a year I was here, my sweetheart from college back home, which she had studied biology and at the same university I was there, she came here. We got married, and I was going to I was doing teaching assistantship, and I was doing studying on my master's. Then I went for the PhD program, and she was doing her master's, her PhD program. God gave us a son after a couple of years. We were married. I loved children. Everything seemed okay. I could drink. I could take care of the family. I could take care of the courses. I could take care of teaching. Everything was okay. But somehow my drinking got worse and worse. You know, it became more and more I had to drink. And I didn't know until I got here that they talk about this disease being progressive. And I remember that after I passed all the required courses for the PhD for physics. And the only reason I mention all these things because I really like to say what Mark was talking about, that one day he talked about, Mark said that he had a gun in his mouth and he had no choice. He was going to kill, blow his brains out, or go to AA. And it came to a point that when I was in college, and when I was in university, in my drinking, at the end of my drinking, and I had a lab over there, and then they gave me a laboratory after I flunked my qualifying exam for physics. I didn't finish it. Then I went to get another degree in engineering called metallurgical engineering. Then they gave me a laboratory, which I was doing research for the government. And this is the time I got introduced to the other drug, cocaine. And then at that time, we didn't have this thing. You had to cook it yourself. They call it freebasing. And I became a master chef. I mean, they gave me this laboratory. It looks like a Frankenstein movie. I have all these glassware, it's called. I was working on something called high temperature corrosion of the ceramics, and then I worked with a lot of toxic gases. We have to calibrate them, and that's why we had all these unlimited source of glassware. And I was going through like a boxes of test tubes every week, and then, you know, I break them every time, you know, I do this stuff, and then, you know, and the government expects me to make publications, and you know, for a couple of years I was doing this, I did an intensive research on how to cook cocaine, you know. It came to a point that at the end of my drinking that I was in my lab and I didn't want to live like that anymore. I had lost a daughter. I had lost my wife. At that time, we were separated. She could not take, you know, I was drinking every night. I was going to bars. I could not stop drinking. And my son was about 5 years old at that time. And I had this laboratory, and I was told campus police that I was running experiments and I have to check my experiments every 2 hours. So I had to get the key to get to my lab at any time. And I'm going to bars every night in Chicago. I mean, if somebody has been to Chicago on Rush Street, you know, all these bars over there, they knew me. And the bartenders were my best buddies. And because I go over there, I love Chicago. If somebody wants to drink, I don't know how they can be an alcoholic in San Diego. I mean, everything closes at 2 o'clock in the morning here. Over there in Chicago, you go out about midnight. They are open until 5 o'clock in the morning, the bars. Then after we close the bar, we go to the suburbs. And we drink all day. And my best buddies were bartenders and bar owners because that's what we did. I go in and I start drinking, and then at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning when they close the bar, then I can go with them and drink more. And by this time, I was not making any progress in research, and I was almost going to get fired, and my wife had left. We were separated, and she was asking for a divorce, and you know, and I thought I could not live like this. What was baffling me that I had read a lot of books. I knew philosophy and I knew science. But it was so baffling that why is it that I don't want to drink and I cannot stop drinking? You know, that all my knowledge could not help me. And I couldn't understand that I can do quantum mechanics problems. I can teach it, but I cannot stop drinking. You know, I mean, it was... So, I was talking to a friend of us, a guy before that. He's another engineer like me. But you know that you, why is it that I wish not to drink? I had all the reasons not to drink, and I could not stop drinking. So I had a gun in my mouth, one night in my lap, and I thought I'm going to end that because I can't live like this anymore. But not, but unlike Mark, I didn't know nothing about AA. I lived in Chicago for many years. I was educated and I was an educator, but I didn't know nothing about AA. The only AA I knew in Chicago was American Airlines. So it's so important to know, today I know this, that my primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics, because as much as AA is fashionable in Southern California, especially in San Diego, everybody goes to AA. But, you know, I bet you within a couple miles radius from here, there are hundreds of us that are suffering from this disease and they don't know there is a way out. And that was my situation. You know, I couldn't make the choice. I mean, and I suffered. I suffered a lot more. I mean, I really suffered, you know, that a couple years after that until I got sober. So when I got here, I was done drinking. And I think I like what Karen talked about, the gal who took the 5 years cake. You know, she mentioned about the surrender for newcomers. You know, when I was new, man, every time somebody from the podium was saying something to the newcomers, I would just sit there and say, oh, this is another one. Like, you know, I really didn't like it. But somebody from podium said, now for the newcomers this and for the newcomer that. And I look at the guy and I says, man, have you looked at your face in the mirror this morning? You know, you want what we have. I didn't want anything that they had. But if you're new, I like to... I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I only have one message for you. The war is over, and you have lost. Hallelujah. That's it. And that was my case. When I got here, I surrendered. I mean, I was done drinking. And I really appreciate what the old-timers at that time used to say. Either you're done or you're not, you know, you're gonna get drunk. And I was done drinking. I lost everything in Chicago. My wife divorced me, and I didn't have nothing. That night, which I was in my lap, and I was trying to blow my brains out, and I was writing a letter to my son, explaining to him that why I had to do this, and the phone in my lap rang, and my parents lived in San Diego. They had gone in and came here in 1980, right after Revolution, because they couldn't stay there. And it was my mother, and I had already, my dad tried to come to San Diego, to Chicago, a couple of weeks before that, he flew in, and then I met him at the airport, and I said, did you bring me any money? And I was like, I could never talk down to my dad. I called him sir all the time. And I said, did you bring any money for me? He said, no, I came to see how you are doing. And I said, get the hell out of here. And I left him at the airport, and I came back. So it was my mother on the other line. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning in Chicago time, you know, something like that, and probably at like midnight in San Diego. And my mother was on the other line and called me, and I said, Mom, it's two, you know, just 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm running my experiments in the lab. You know, why are you calling me here? And this woman was crying really hard, you know. And I don't know. Maybe, like, you know, maybe most of us, we get here because of a prayer of Al-Anon or something. I don't know. But she would not, and I was explaining to her, you know, I have things to do here, and, you know, I have business. She was crying and asking me to go to come to San Diego. She wanted to see me one last time or whatever. And I was telling her how busy I was. She would not give up. For half an hour, this woman was sobbing on telephone. I don't know if she knew something or not. I don't know. But I gave up. And I says, okay, if you send me a ticket, a round-trip ticket, so I can come from Chicago to San Diego for one day only. I see you and I come back because I have stuff to take care of. And they sent me a ticket. And I came to San Diego. That was in 1987. The next time I went back to Chicago was about 5 years later when I had 4 years sobriety. So I don't know how things work out. But I came to San Diego and I had lost everything. And I was trying to get maybe a teaching job at city colleges, you know, and, you know, to make my living. I didn't have nothing, absolutely nothing. And then I got into sales. A friend of mine suggested that, and somehow I became like a hotshot salesman. I started making really good money, and I was back. You know, I had an apartment in La Mesa, and I got into into drinking again really hard. And then the place I was working, one day the owner of the place called me and says, "You're an asset to our company, but you're going to die." And they knew. And I was drinking, and I was like, you know, I mean, in bad shape. And they sent me to treatment center. They said, "Give me the key for your car." The guy told me, you know, I had a demo, a car from the company. And then they took the key away from me. They said, "You're going to go to treatment center." And they sent me to McDonald's Center. And I'm grateful for my former boss that, you know, he intervened, because I didn't know nothing about AA. The best thing about the treatment center is that they introduced us to, after they took me to the meetings with the van, and I got into AA. And right there, somehow something happened that I knew there is a way I can stay sober. And I started reading the book. I loved the book. And I'm trying to fasten it up, to hurry up, because is it 10 minutes? Did you make a mistake? Okay. All right. Thank you. I was going to, I can talk really fast with Farsi if you want me to, man. I mean, You almost got me nervous again, man. I remember when I was at the treatment center, it was so baffling for me to know that somebody like me, with my caliber, with my degrees, I have a couple postgraduate degrees, how would I end up in a treatment center? They are talking about alcoholics and drug addicts and stuff like that. And we had, like, I was about 2 weeks into treatment center, and you know, I haven't had drink for 2 weeks. But they put me the first week in the recovery section of it. They put me in so much Valium because I had some speed in my body, like I was quick. And then the second week we were in another section of the building, and it was primary and then recovery, I think. And one night, I got up 2 o'clock in the morning, and we have a cafeteria in that treatment center. And I went to cafeteria because you could just smoke. And I started smoking, and I got my notebook out. And somehow, it had dawned on me that why somebody with my caliber ends up in a treatment center. And I started writing about with all the science which I knew, and mathematics and statistics, that why people, they come to treatment center and they come to AA and they go out, get drunk again. So basically, I wrote about 20 pages why AA doesn't work after I was 2 weeks sober. So I knew that God got me to treatment center mainly because of this reason. I can tell these people why AA doesn't work. So the next day, we went to the groups, you know, we sat down for, we had a group, about 10 of us, we sit over there with a counselor at 10 o'clock in the morning. And the counselor is a good friend of mine. His name is John Seaman, and we have like lunch every month together. And he can really say this story better than I can say it. But we sat down at the meeting, and the first, I was so excited that, hey, I have got the answer, why am I here? They had a blackboard over there, and they would write down character defects and stuff like for people. And next to my name was like junkie PhD, and this is really pissing me off. That how could they treat me like this? Don't they know what a great scientist I am? And we sat down, and I raised my hand. John, I want to share something with the group. And he says, go ahead. And I grabbed my notebook, and I started reading all the math and the statistics about alcoholism, why AA doesn't work. And I don't know, maybe it took 10, 15 minutes. I went through the whole thing. And when it was finished, you know, there was a silence in the room. And I mean, I was pretty much sure that, you know, probably they're going to, you know, stand in ovation. Maybe everybody's going to stand and clap, like, you know, not just sitting at least, you know. And then, I mean, I was sure that John probably is going to ask me to become the head counselor at the treatment center now, like, you know, with all my knowledge. And there, you know, I mean, I had my head down, and I think it took like a long time. Maybe it was a few seconds, but to me it was a long time. And I brought my head up, and I look at John's face, and I never forget his face. He looked at me, and he said, "Sam, you are a very sick man." But somehow I got to the meetings, I got a sponsor, and I started doing what we do around here. I start doing setting up chairs. I mean, for the first 10 years of my sobriety, my job was to mop the floor at this meeting, La Jolla Speakers, somewhere up there. And after everybody left, they had the hardwood floors at that time, nice carpet. And I would mop the floors, and then I had to go clean the bathrooms. And then I had to, the worst one was, picking up cigarette butts at the parking lot because after everybody left, because they had the church services the next day. And I was telling my sponsor at that time, "Listen, you don't understand. Now I'm sober a year. I got to go back to Chicago. I got to get my wife back. I got to get my job back, And they gave me a coffee can, and, he said, "You go pick up cigarette butts in the parking lot." From the beginning, I knew all these sponsors in AA are so insensitive, all of them. And I used to go home, and I pick up the cigarette butts, and I didn't want to do it. And I used to go home and, do it and say, "These alcoholics, God knows what kind of diseases they have. I wash my hands like 200 times with alcohol, with everything, But anyhow, it worked. Whatever I did, it worked. It kept me sober. And after a year, I went back to treatment center. A bunch of nurses and counselors, they said, they were so surprised. I was the one, everybody had put the money. There was no way I can stay sober. So if you're new, there is hope here. I mean, this is a program for people. I can describe AA in three words. Action, action, action. I mean, this is the program to do. We are here to do it. If we do it, it's going to work. I believe that everybody is going to stay sober as long as we do the things around here. I had a sponsor. I went to meetings. After a couple of years, I was sober. I was thinking about that. When everybody talks about the miracles in AA, when this miracle is going to happen to me. I come to meetings, I didn't have my wife back yet. Thanks God. I didn't have my kids, And so it just dawned on me, I was about a year and a half sober, I was thinking about what is this miracle everybody talks about. It just dawned on me that I was brought up Muslim, I got sober on Christmas Day, and my first sponsor was a Jew. That took care of it. I knew that something is going to work in here. I says, you know what? I don't need to look for miracles anymore. I have had a great journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love AA. I was about 12 years sober, and I knew that alcohol and drugs is a big, big problem back home. I haven't been back home for you. I've been just once back home. And like the young generation, especially after revolution, that we have religious government over there. There is no young people. They don't know what to do. From a country which was like Paris, Tehran before revolution, we had everything Western, modernized. Everything was like it was closed. And young people, they had nothing to do. They got into drinking and they got into drugs. It was murdering, eliminating the young people. When I went back there, it's just amazing that people start from 13, 14 years old. You see kids in 17, 18 years old. They're so much advanced in alcoholism and doing drugs. They have lost their teeth, 17 years old. Physically, they have paid a big price. So 12 years ago, about 13 years ago, I went back home and we had a few guys from Los Angeles, they have translated the first 164 pages. A couple of guys from back there about 19 years ago. And they took it back there. We had the big book translated, and we had some NA meeting going on over there. And NA meeting started over there with AA Big Book. And I went over there, and I started, you know, going to meetings. We started some meetings over there. We, 12, 13 years ago, we started the first AA meeting over there in the holy city of Mashhad, which is the holiest city in Iran, and it's right close to the Afghanistan border. And we were about 10, 12 of us, you know, and it was a big book of study. And I've had the privilege going back there every year. I go back there every year. And I was there 2 months ago, again, I got back in the whole month of November. And we have over 25,000 members right now. We have meetings. And I didn't know that, you know, that this is going to happen. It was just one drunk talking to another drunk. I went over there as a drunk, and I started talking to a couple other drunks. And we have meetings all over the country. It's, you know, the every year I go over there, they be because they didn't have the 12 by 12. They don't have all the literature here we have here. They don't have all the high, you know, the sobriety we have here. I mean, they think that when I go over there, I'm Bill Wilson. You know, they treat me like, you know, for gods. You know. So I travel to different cities, and I set up step study workshops, you know, which is really not step study the way we have it here, structured here. It's mostly about taking, showing the people how to go through the steps according to the big book, take them through the big book. And it's like 2-3 days events, 3 hours in the morning, 3 hours in the afternoon. We have Al-Anon coming in, you know, that we have, you know, the Al-Anons were coming, you know, Al-Anon is big over there. You know, when I was about 2 years sober, I was sponsoring guys, I was involved in AA a lot, but somehow I was losing my enthusiasm about AA. I don't know why. And a friend of mine, a good friend of mine, she has 10 years more sobriety than I do, she told me, why don't you go to Alateen? I was missing my son. And my wife at this time wanted to get remarried, she wanted some divorce papers, and I didn't know if I, like, you know... You know, I want to mention this about the ninth step, you know, that somehow we do things that are based on faith only. When I was doing my ninth step, I remember that I was a few months sober, and my sponsor said, you're going to send child support for your son. And they lived in Chicago, and I could see him once for a week in the summer. My wife would allow me there to, and then talk to him on telephone. And the first thing came to my mind when my sponsor said, you're going to send child support. I said, you know what? No, no, no. You don't understand. If I send the money, she's going to use it. You know, and it was, they told me that, you know, it's none of your business. You send the money. And I sent the money at that time, not because I wanted to be a nice guy, not to because I wanted to be a good father. I just didn't want to drink no more. Every action I have done in Alcoholics Anonymous, the main reason for it was because I didn't want to drink no more. I was so much done drinking. And I sent them money. Then about a year after that, she wanted to get me remarried, and she wanted some divorce paper in Farsi or something, which I don't know if I had it. I didn't want to give it to her at that time, or I didn't have it. But then she said I could not talk to my son, and I could not see him. So I went back to my sponsor, and I says, I told you how she is. Like, you know, I'm going to go back to Chicago. I'm a year and a half sober. I'm a good citizen, and I'm going to ask for custody. You know, it's my right to see my son. And this is the time they brought me to right after the 10th step. It talks about we have ceased fighting everything and everybody. And it didn't make no sense to me at that time when my sponsor brought it to my attention. He says, you send the money, and then send a nice letter also. And I did that because I didn't want to drink no more. Send the money, and I sent the letter. And for about almost a year, I didn't get the chance to talk to my son. And we talk about the dark night of the soul. That was for me to sit in the dark sometimes and say, and just take it. I had to surrender. And then after a year, he called me, and then, you know, if my son, he lives in San Mateo, and he's an attorney now. If he was here right now, standing next to me, and I'm not exaggerating, you would think we are one soul in two bodies. He's my son, he's my buddy, he's my pal. We have traveled all over the world together, from Europe to the South America to New Zealand. I mean, the relationship I have with him is beyond anything I can describe. Over 20, almost 23 years ago, when I started making amends, 23 and a half years ago, and at that time I didn't know my son is going to be in my... I started making amends because I didn't want to drink no more. I didn't know that, you know, I'm going to have a relationship with him beyond anything I can imagine. AA works. The steps, they work. But it's a slow process. It's a healing process, but it takes a long time. You know, don't give us a week or 6 months or 1 year or something. We want you to give us a lifetime. That's what my buddy says, Joe. So back home, we have this meeting going on, and when I went to the ALA team meeting when I was 2 years sober, and these kids, they sit down for about a year. I would go over there and sit in the meeting. They don't say anything. Then little by little, I became friends with them. I love ALA team because the way they work, the steps, these kids, is so real. Their problems, the way they talk about, you know, what's going on with them. And then 12 years ago, I was involved in starting the first ALA team meetings back home. So I didn't know what I'm trying to say. I didn't know 22 years ago. I went to some ALA team meetings that somehow 12 years later, I end up to be of service to help start ALA team meetings. So when we have meetings over there, ALA and non-ALA team, everybody comes over to the meetings, the one for the step study. So 5 years ago, I was in the city of Mashhad, and I had a big meeting going on after the meeting. I want to say this. The same way, when I come here, people, they ask me, how are the meetings over there? When I'm over there, people, they're asking me, how are the meetings over, you know, back in the U.S.? It's exactly the same meeting. The names are different only. It's the language of heart. The sharing, everything is exactly identical. You know, here we have meetings in churches, you know, over there we have meetings in mosques. And I like to see this. As much as, I mean, religion people, and nothing against religion people, but they're fanatics. But the officials, the government is 100% behind us. I mean, our government here with their government is like this. But over there, they support us. A few years ago, I was in this city, Mashhad, and then we had a big meeting. It was like, I spoke for like 3 hours, and there were about like 3,000 people in this big complex. And then they had closed-circuit TVs outside. There were a couple thousand people outside. And then after the meeting, you know, the next day they asked me to go to the governor's office, you know, in Mashhad, and we went over there. And there some officials, government officials were there. And they were very open-minded. It's amazing when it comes to this, because they see it works. 12 years ago, 13 years ago when I was back there, they didn't know what to do with them. In the squares of the capital, I saw these big posters. It says, an addict is a criminal. They treat you as a criminal. If you drank, it was lashes. And, you know, but somehow they say this is working. And so we went to the governor's office, and then we were sitting with the deputy, or somebody was talking to us, you know, and I was explaining to them about Alcoholics Anonymous a little bit. And then they said, okay, this is great. We like to help you out anywhere. We have a budget. The Department of Health here has a budget for, you know, to help the alcoholics. And we told them, we don't need your money. And they are like, you know, then we explained a little about the seven traditions, you know. They couldn't understand that at all. And, you know, so the guy told me, I know this, like, you know, you flew from Capitol at 12 o'clock or something, noon. By like 6 o'clock, when you guys had about 5,000 people coming to listening to you. How did you get all these people in one place? What, I mean, we want to do that, we have to give like free food, free blanket or something to these people. And so while we were talking, then this other guy came in. I think that was his boss or somebody. And he said, you know, they introduced us. And he said, so What do you know? He was talking to his deputy, and his deputy said, "Sir, we told them that we have some budget, you know, some money, but they won't accept our money." And then the guy said, "You know, so who are they?" He said, "Sir, I don't know. They won't tell us." So, I have the privilege to work with a lot of alcoholics back there. The last 3 years, 4 years, they were trying so hard to register the name with the government. And we could not do that because the government was opposing the name of alcoholic. You can't use the word alcoholic. You know, you're alcoholic, alcohol is forbidden. Although all these religions, most of them, I know, they're drunks. They're on the way to AA meetings, maybe. But they said you can't use the word alcoholic. Because if you say that, you admit you have drank, you have to get 80 lashes. So we figured maybe we have to change the third tradition. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking and 80 lashes. But no, we don't. And then they had the word anonymous they were opposing. They said you can't use that word. Anonymous was reserved for some of the Revolutionary Guards who died during the Iran-Iraq War, the 8 years war in 1980s. And they said you can't use the word anonymous, you can't use the word alcoholic. So the word sober has an immense spiritual value in Farsi language. So last year I was over there. We have registered the name of Alcoholics Anonymous in Iran under the name of Sobers Without Name. And, yes, so that's why we have AA in Iran. So either we call it Alcoholics Anonymous here or Sobers Without Name in Iran. What we have here, I'm so grateful that I got drunk in a time we have Alcoholics Anonymous. And I mean that. What we have here is beyond cultures, beyond borders, beyond governments, beyond countries. You know, at this time, which whatever is going on in the world, I mean, this is something, I mean, I'm so grateful. I mean, this is a divinely inspired program. I have no doubt in my mind today that, you know, God somehow gave this gift to this planet. I think this is the greatest movement in the contemporary man history. I mean, I don't know anything about this. And we have given every single one of us. I mean, I was there last time I was over there, and I was traveling to different cities, and I have this, my iPad in my ear. I was listening to my Zoom in my ear, and I was listening, you know, and I have a cell phone with me. When I go over there, it's like we have from 7 o'clock in the morning, I get up, I'm involved with AA until midnight. You know, there is so much, and he talks about in the 12th step, a wonderful energy is released. It's not me. I know myself. And I was telling my sponsor. My sponsor called me, and I said, you know what, I travel all over. I mean, the 3-4 weeks I'm over there, I travel 10 different cities, and I have meetings going on, and I don't know how I do it. And he told me this. He says, you know how that happens? And I said, no. He says, you disappear. This is a good friend of mine. We call him Barry from British Barry. He talks about this program is about from I become we. You know. And I was sitting, I think the second years I was over there, this guy in a meeting asked me. He was sitting at the meeting. He asked me, he said, Sam, you know, you come in here, you have meetings from morning to afternoon. Then after the meetings, they come in, the guys and everybody, they come to me and they're asking me about their personal life. 90% of it is sexual things, you know, that they want to know, not they got sober, what's going on with them. You know, and, you know, I have like hours talking to these people. He asked me, how do you get this energy? And I knew at that time, this is not my energy, has nothing to do with me, it's not coming from me. Every single one of us is given this opportunity to go help another alcoholic, to have that feeling. Because when you disappear, you get a glimpse of that great reality, which the book talks about it. You know, and every one of us can experience that. It's simple. A drunk like me, who couldn't stay away from booze even for one day, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. For 34 years, for 34 years of my sobriety, of my life, I was a loser. I was a failure. Not a loser, I was a failure. As a father, as a son, as a teacher, I was a failure. I did it. I did all those things. And for the last 24 years, I have been a success, and I had nothing to do with it. I thank God, and I thank you people. Thank you.